Ron Porter and then Clint DeFrance.
No microphone.
Oh, okay. This is with no microphone. Doug, a little clarity. I certainly agree that this is the picture of the symbolic blessings, the Messianic kingdom. And he would have had to say it in the language they understood, even though it's figurative, because otherwise it had no understanding of it. But you mentioned about the different views of how to interpret it. Now, we do have some passages, don't we, that literally refer to the rebuilding of the temple when they come out of captivity. Mm-hmm. And that, so, mm-hmm. we do have to recognize there's that group of passages that relate to the rebuilding when they come out of the captivity. But even that language is used to point, for example, to the further fulfillment in the spiritual.
Yeah.
The reason I brought that up, I was just trying to follow you carefully. And the point is that we have to separate some languages, some prophecies relating to rebuilding the temple when they came out.
Yeah. Concerning that, in Ezekiel and some of the other prophets as well, there are many passages that foretell a restoration of God's people from captivity. Some of those, perhaps many of them, I don't know the exact number, some of those refer to the literal coming back from Babylon. They had, I believe that this restoration was a part of the Messianic plan as well. You go to Daniel chapter 9, the 70 weeks vision. First part of that vision is from being called back to rebuild Jerusalem. And then it leads up to the coming of the Messiah and then probably the destruction of Jerusalem. But their coming back was a part of this Messianic plan. At the same time, some of these passages that deal with restoration really talk about restoration from sin. More of a symbolic, a figurative restoration there. We have to spend some time trying to discern the two. And I'll, you know, which one's talking about. Most of the time in Ezekiel, I think he's talking about a return from Babylonian captivity for those folks.
The second thing that I found helpful a long time ago to recognize that Jerusalem wasn't yet destroyed when Ezekiel was in captivity. Mm-hmm. And when you realize that, you don't take some of those prophecies and misapply them. Mm-hmm. Not always to me. That mm-hmm. really helped me. Mm-hmm.
Ezekiel went to captivity in 597. The city wasn't destroyed until 586, and he didn't hear about it till months afterwards. So there's a period of time while he's in captivity, like you say, the temple was still in existence.
Clint DeFrance.
Brother, you mentioned a little bit about different ideas about the identity of the prince and his function. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could elaborate on.
Okay. You know, I think that would make a really good study topic someday, because I have kind of gone back and forth over this prince and the identity of this prince. There are several commentators that claim this is not the Messiah. And there are some that say this is the Messiah. Now, if you say that it's a Messiah, there's a couple of things that are said about him that are pretty interesting. For example, it said that he has children. And it also says that he offers these sacrifices along with the people. So I have kind of flip-flopped back and forth on that. If I were to take a position now, I think that I might say that he is a representation of the Messiah, but don't make all the details about who he is have to mean something spiritually. I think we can bog down on symbols when you start trying to make every little detail compared to something in the Christian age. You have to be careful sometimes not to allegorize everything. And this prince, whoever he is above the people. He leads the people in worship. He has the privilege of going into this eastern gate that no one else can go to. He goes in there and he gets to eat this fellowship meal, which it never says that he's a priest, but that's a priest activity to eat of that meal. So at least this point, I do kind of think perhaps this may be a representation of the Messiah. James Smith, in his little book on Ezekiel and others, thinks that it is. Jim McGuigan and some of the others think that it's not. So that's kind of a divided issue over that. But it could be an interesting study too.
Can I ask one more?
Okay.
I wondered if you could comment on the significance of no furniture being in this temple except for that altar, you know, no mm-hmm. table of showbread, no lampstand, and no Ark of the Covenant.
Well, it's interesting that instead of the Ark of the Covenant being there, God's presence was going to be there. I really can't answer that because I don't know why. I don't know why there is that one wooden altar in there and nothing else. Now, some of the commentators think that wooden altar is a table of showbread, but it never says it. It just says a wooden altar right going into the most holy place. The Ark of the Covenant, you know, was lost at some point, and it doesn't appear that the Ark of the Covenant was in the temple after Babylonian captivity. And the only thing, this may just be an educated guess, is that the presence of God replaces the need for these symbolic articles of furniture.
Nathan Benton. Appreciate that very much. That's very good and interesting. One of the things that kind of stands out when you're studying about whether it's the first temple or this temple here is the symmetry and all the calculations that are going on and the symmetry that's being projected in the charts that the people draw. I just want to make comment. I mentioned this to you briefly in the back earlier. In Ezekiel chapter 47, verses 9 and 10, this river that's flowing out from the temple out the eastern gate and becomes wider and deeper as it goes. There's these trees that are coming along the side of it. The life is being produced. It's filled with a swarm of fish, and there are fishermen catching a great number of fish in their nets. Richard Bauckham, in his book Gospel of Glory, makes the point, I think it's worth considering. In Luke chapter 5, you have the scene of the great catch of fishes. And it's after the great catch of fish that Jesus says, "Come and I will make you fishers of men." And then later on in John chapter 21, you have the second great catch of fish, and he is recommissioning them as they're going to go out and to spread the gospel message. And Bauckham's point was, where do we see a great catch of fish in nets by men in a setting that seems to be the gospel age, and it seems to be a link back to Ezekiel chapter 47, verse 9.
Yeah. Yeah, I would not argue with that at all. But that symbolically seems to be portraying the preaching of the gospel. And just in general, this river coming out, you know, is a river of blessings. God's people are being blessed. Not just the trees on either side for fruit, for the healings of the nation, but the fishermen. It's whatever it means. It has to be the spiritual blessings that are available for God's people in the future, coming from God Himself. You know, we would say coming from being a part of the church and everything, and surely the preaching of the gospel is a part of that as well.
That kind of struck me when I read it, because the river, if it's a literal temple, the river flowing in a literal description like it's described here seems to be a huge problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of the things that caused me to think pretty seriously about that idea that it was a literal temple supposed to be built after Babylonian captivity, but it wasn't because the people did not obey. Well, the problem I had with that, like you mentioned there, is that this river is there, and that river is symbolic. Doesn't seem to be literal. And if the river, which is an important part of this picture, is symbolic, then at least in consistency, at least part or maybe most of the other part would have to be symbolic as well.
George Batty.
Doug, you said this temple was not built in Jerusalem. Is not the building site was not Jerusalem? Where'd you get that from? Because I
okay. always assumed it was. Okay, in Ezekiel, when he distributes the land, the temple is built right here in the middle of this part that goes to the Zadok priests. The city, Jerusalem, is built in another section. Now, they're close together. I'm not saying they're separated by a long ways. I'm just saying that in this vision, it has the temple here and the city in the little section of land below that. That this is where the people would live. The workers lived and worked in these areas around the city here and then lived in the city. This is where the Zadok priests lived with the temple proper in there. And then the Levites lived in this area up there.
Okay. In chapter 48, you've got this distribution of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get to the temple is in the center of this land that belongs to the priests and the Levites. And it gives the dimensions. And I'm told that if you convert these dimensions of 25,000 cubits and so forth, you got the priests with their land around the temple, and you've got Levites outside of that with 25,000 cubits. And I'm told that if you multiply that out, it cannot fit literally in that segment of land between the sea and the Mediterranean, which indicates that this should not be interpreted literally, is what I'm told.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, I think so. There's even some confusion over the size of this place. In Ezekiel's passage, he says that it's 500 rods, but everybody I checked with said it's 500 cubits. Because there's confusion over whether it should be translated rod or cubit. Now, if it's a rod, remember that a rod was 6 cubits long. So if this is 500 rods, that's 500 times 6. And so it gets even larger than the 875 feet that they said this literally was. So there is confusion in the passage a little bit over some of these items of measurement, whether he's talking about a rod or whether he's talking about a cubit. You know, in the year, let me just add this. This is just kind of additional. In year 8095, a lot of the rabbis got together at a certain council. I can't remember the name of it offhand.
Jamnia?
Yeah, I think so. And they argued over which books are going to be in the Old Testament. And they included Ezekiel and 3 or 4 other books, Esther, some other books like that. And they were very close to taking Ezekiel out because there seems to be some differences between sacrifice and all the specifics under the law of Moses and the sacrifices under the temple. There seemed to be some contradictions on things. And so they were ready to throw Ezekiel out of the canon. But a certain rabbi came to the rescue, I guess, of Ezekiel, and it said that he shut himself up in a room and burned 300 jars of oil, you know, to light the place, until he was able to completely reconcile Ezekiel and Leviticus, and so therefore it stayed a part of the canon. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that's what several historians referred to.
Just to maybe highlight a little statement you made about not every little detail of a vision necessarily has a corresponding fulfillment when the prophecy is fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
In Daniel 7 and verse 1, it says, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. There were some details in the dream that he had he didn't write down, which seemed to indicate that not every detail is important in understanding mm-hmm. how the prophecy is to be fulfilled.
Yeah. You know, the vision of that statue in Daniel 2, you know, it talks about his toes. If I'm mistaken, it doesn't say he has 10 toes, does he?
No.
And yet, that's a pretty important part of dispensational, that there has to be this 10-nation confederation based upon the 10 toes of the image in Daniel. But the thing about it is, it doesn't say it had 10 toes. Jim McGuigan, in his commentary on Ezekiel, says that there's kind of two ways you can understand this. He says, you can understand this like an allegory, where that everything has to parallel the New Testament, like the temple represents the church, the priesthood represents Christians, the animal sacrifices represent Christ, the prince represents Christ, and you know, every little detail has to represent something. He said that's one way of looking at it, as an allegory, but he says that in his view, at least, he says that this is a picture of the New Testament age, and not every detail has to line up and parallel. And I kind of think he's right on that. That you don't have to make every detail on this represent something in the church. If you do, you know, you come up with a lot of stuff to try to allegorize.
Ron Porter.
You know, Doug, I don't see why we have such a problem to not recognize every detail doesn't have to be in prophecy, a prophecy, because we do exactly the same thing with a parable, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
If we take a parable and take everything, every detail in it, we're probably going to miss what the parable is about.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's kind of a nice analogy there to make us think about that.
Yeah. Some of this stuff is for details. It's not intended to be a particular spiritual truth. It's details to the picture. You know, things in the background in the picture, maybe. Maybe I should say it that way. Background of the picture to help us see the picture, to help us see the key points in it.